The taping today is December 13th. We're doing Mishlei. And we just happen to be at the end of Sefer Bereishis. And it's an amazing thing to do to compare these proverbs, these Egyptian proverbs that we've been reading and that I gave to you, with to compare it to Yosef's behavior at the end of Sefer Bereishis. If Shlomo was aware of these proverbs, it stands to reason because some of them predate Yosef also. That's quite a bit of time before Shlomo, right? From Yosef to Shlomo is 700 years, right? So some of these proverbs predate Yosef also. So don't be surprised if Yosef was also aware of these proverbs. You hear it? Okay. And that Yosef's behavior is manifest in some ways as someone who feels that there is, remember I called you sapiential literature? He feels that I want to perfect myself and my personal characteristics. Obviously, be careful. The nature of a proverb probably transcends societies, right? Would you expect that a proverb from ancient India and a proverb from, Ireland of 200 years ago and a proverb... Maybe you get these little books. I get once a month. I get a book with a bunch of proverbs from all over the world. Right? It helps me with my Musar moments that I do on Friday night at the end of davening. Right? The best things in life aren't things. You get that? That could come from a Chinese ancient proverb. It could come from a Yiddish proverb. It could, you know what I'm saying? So, I think that proverbs might transcend cultures and societies, but be careful. In Egypt, someone in charge, right? Someone in charge the way Yosef is. You following? You know, there's no... Nothing holds back his hand to do anything he wants. You know what I'm saying? Now, we should pursue the point, I know this is Mishlei and I have to get right back into the text, but we should pursue the point that when Chazal say Yosef remained the tzaddik he always was in Egypt, right? So why do Chazal call Yosef a tzaddik? Moshe's not called Moshe a tzaddik. Avram is not called Avram HaTzadik. In fact, in all of Tanakh, only one person is actually called a Tzadik. And that is?
Yosef.
Noach. Yosef is not called a Tzadik. Not in any story. In the Haftorah of Parashas Vayeshev, it says, Al Michrom Bakesef Tzadik Ve'evyon Bavur Na'alayim. Right? So if you're connecting that to Yosef's story, it's okay. Who is it that but Yosef? So they sell the Tzadik. But not one perush to the pasuk in Amos, where that appears in Perek Beis pasuk Dalet, on the pasuk, not even Rashi, says that that's talking about Yosef. It's talking about selling innocent people into slavery because they can't pay back a debt on a pair of shoes. Not the debt on a house or a boat, but the debt on a pair of shoes. That's how bad things were. Okay? Not on gambling debt, not a pair of shoes. People were going to debtor's prison. That's how bad things are, and that's why Amos says, God is not going to allow you this to remain much longer. Right? So that tzaddik isn't even Yosef according to the Pshat. Okay, but what is the definition of a tzaddik? Why is Noah called a tzaddik? So I will tell you Yecheskel, in two places, puts two other biblical characters together with Noah in their tzidkus, Iov and Daniel. Noach, Iov, and Daniel, what do they have in common? Is that they rise above everyone else around them. You hear that? Tzaddik is above everyone else around them. We discussed earlier this semester the relative nature of tzedek and chesed. And I told you that etymologically, chesed is higher than tzedek. But... I don't know, willy-nilly, how the words have come down to us, The chosid is one of 100,000 Belzer people. The tzaddik is the one at the top of them. He's the queen bee, you know? All right? So, okay, be it, so be it. And you can call a lot of people chasidim, but tzaddik is really should be left for... I don't like when people say, hey, come here, tzaddik. Yeah, they throw around the word tzaddik. Right? If you hear people talk that way, especially in Israel, Spartans who do it a lot. Come here, tzaddik. Right? Come on. Tzaddik is one in 1,000. Not every little guy you call him. Right? So, Yosef is called Yosef HaTzaddik. And Rashi insists at the beginning of Shmos that Yosef always remained the tzaddik he was while he was in Egypt. And why are we talking about this? Because I would like to tie it to you that Yosef was aware of most of these proverbs I gave to you. And he behaved like that. Okay. Now, look, this proverb is to perfect you. There are psukim in our Mishlei that say things like, be careful, listen to me, don't do that. Be careful how you behave before the king, because the king will do whatever he wants to you. Is that Mishlei's admission that the king has all the rights in the world to kill indiscriminately and take vineyards and take wives from their husbands? Is that what Mishlei is allowing? No, Mishlei is just warning you. This is what kings in the world will think they have the right to do. Okay? How do we know that Yosef remained a tzaddik all those years in Egypt? So I would tell you, according to Rashi, it's Gzeiras HaChasuv. Here are the three words where Rashi says it. V'Yosef Hayot V'Mitzrayim. This is where Rashi writes that Yosef was a tzaddik all those years in Egypt. So I got to tell you, bad Mefarshei Rashi. There are 300 of them. Some are not always bad, but sometimes they give a pshat in Rashi, which I think is bad pshat. There is some Mefarshei Rashi that looks, see in those three words, what are they? That he remained a tzaddik? Because it doesn't say, Tzofnas Paneach Hayot V'Mitzrayim. It says, Yosef Hayot V'Mitzrayim. He didn't become the Tzofnas Paneach that Paro changed him into. He remained the old Yosef, the Hebrew Yosef, right? Then it's up to good Mephorshim to say how Yosef behaved so morally and why the Egyptians loved him and Paro gave in to him, and right? The best parish on that sort that I saw was Yehuda Chosid, who says, why was Yosef asking the brothers about their background? Now we know why, because he wants to hear about his father and... But don't you realize, Yosef, that you're going to blow your cover by asking those questions? Right? You want to get them to do tshuva and be put into a similar situation, to leave a favored son of Yaakov behind, another son of Rachel. So fine. But why are you putting yourself in the danger of being blowing your cover? So the Yehuda Chassid says, Yosef asked everybody who came about their background. Why? Because he wanted to know, how many kids do you have at home? How many mouths do you need to feed? What's your financial situation? And the Egyptians saw him treat everybody according to their own needs. You hear it? It's a beautiful parish, right? Yosef asked everybody these questions. Where did he get the time to do it? He said that he set up a system. All right? In other words, the Egyptians saw him behaving in a moral fashion. It's a mitzvah to explain tzaddikim in a way where if a rabbi gives a sermon on Shabbos, he can learn things. So we should behave the same way, right? Why do I not like this perush that says that because it says Yosef and not Tzofnas Paneach? That sounds like the right thing, right? It's Yosef who remained in Egypt, not this Tzofnas Paneach character who we might not recognize. Why is that not good pshat in Rashi? Talk to me. Does everybody understand the pshat in Rashi, right? Because I wouldn't expect the beginning of Shmos to say, Eile Shmos b'nei Yisrael haboyim Mitzrayim ha'is Yaakov Yishu beis obo Reuven Shimon Levi Yehuda Yisachar Zvulun Yosef u'bin Yomim and say, Tzofnas paneach u'bin Yomim. Right, leaves out Yosef. It says afterwards, Tzofnas Paneach Hayah B'Mitzrayim. Why would I darshan the fact that it doesn't say Tzofnas Paneach if there's no way on planet Earth that I would ever expect the Torah to write Tzofnas Paneach? We darshan the things that are not what I expect. You get it? I wouldn't expect the pasuk to say Tzofnas Paneach Hayah B'Mitzrayim, that I should darshan the fact that it says Yosef instead. Of course it's going to say Yosef. You get it? He's never called Tzofnas Paneach again after the initial time that Paro changes his name. You hear? So what is in those three words that indicates that Yosef remained the same tzaddik he always was? Hayah. He didn't have to say Hayah. It says Yosef b'Mitzrayim. This Yosef Hayah b'Mitzrayim implies, now say, how are we darshaning it? No. He was as he always was. You get it? If the word is extraneous, how are we understanding it? Yosef remained as he was in Egypt. Okay. All right. So part of what you should do when your first assignment, it says compare 10 Egyptian pharaohs to comparable problems in Mishlei, identify differences in approach to morality, character development, and expectation from the fairness of life. Very important. We have certain expectations of how life is fair. You get it? We've spent a lot of time this semester talking about Koheles and Mishlei. Okay. Right. Okay. So that's just an interesting thing to do. Is to show that how Yosef is acting out what you know the character development, but be careful. Here's a morality issue on our side. Yaakov at the end of Sefer Bereishis is going to decide which son of his is going to bear the scepter. Which son of his is going to be the ruler over the others. Guys, shouldn't it be obvious who should be? To Yaakov? They're all bowing down to him. He's got leadership qualities. He's the one that is acting as king. How could Yaakov, on his deathbed, take wrest the kingship from Yosef and give it to Yehuda? Right? Now Yosef does get something. There are two kingdoms in Israel. There's a northern tribes that are from Shevet Ephraim. So that's Yosef. There are two Mashiachs, two kings, Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David. Right? This week's Haftorah is the main story in Tanakh, really. Yechezkel chapter 36, 37, about the conjoining of the two kingdoms in the future. Right? Really look at it. And for obvious reasons, Yehuda and Yosef confront each other in the Torah reading. So the Torah has Yehuda and Yosef as two trees, and the rest is clear. All right. So why does Yosef lose the kingship? So this is my claim. This deserves to be some kind of. Can use this as a. Maybe write an article or something. He behaved too much like an Egyptian monarch. He took too much. He went a little too far.
Where?
You see, what was the purpose of raking his brothers to the coals the way he did? He was waiting for them. He knew they would come. He was ready for them. Right? What does he want to make sure happened to them in the ensuing, it's been 20 years? Okay? 13 plus 7, it's been 20 years. All right? They don't recognize him, he recognizes them. Right? What does he want to do with them? What's his purpose here? So it could be he wants to make sure his dreams come true. He wants to make sure they know it. It's a little vindictive, okay, but maybe he felt the dream was a prophecy and I want it to become true. Maybe he just wants to punish them a little. That's pretty small. What does he really want to do? Ramban and Ravenel, It's a big picture kind of thing that Rashi doesn't really get into. But when you read the whole Rashi parsha, you see what Yosef wants to be sure of, which is, no, come on, guys.
Make sure that
they're true. Yeah, have we fixed Sefer Bereishis or not? Does Yosef know the whole Sefer Bereishis? He probably knows enough to consider that my father had some issues with his brother. Right? Got it? My grandfather Yitzchak had some issues with Ishmael. He may know a story about Cain killing Hevel. Right? He may know that Avraham and Lot's shepherds didn't get along so well and they had to split up. What does Yosef see in Sefer Bereishis? Not in the Sefer, of course, it doesn't exist yet, but in the stories of close family stories.
He sees a pattern
of
brothers
don't get along. And I may have been at fault for continuing that pattern at first, right? It's a beautiful Maimar Chazal that says that the Beis HaMikdash, Yaakov also decides where the Beis HaMikdash is going to be built on his deathbed. He says, if you're not attuned to it, you won't find it. But he says, God will reside between the shoulders of Binyamin. He says, Bein Kasefov Shochein. If you look at Har HaBayis, you don't see it now because the Romans quarried it all out. But Har HaBayis looks like a head between two shoulders. One shoulder is Har HaZeisim, and the other shoulder is just the topography on the other side, which is now Western Jerusalem. But Bein Kasefov Shochein, that Avram saw from far, on his way up from Hebron, he could see it. Probably Avram was like near the Tayelet, that you know in Talpiot. You can see the whole Yerushalayim in front of you. That's probably where Avram was coming up, where he saw the Makom Merachok. It had to be there, because that was the highest place there. Now it seems to be a little lower than Har HaZeisim. The Romans quarried that whole area out. So it says, God says, Yaakov says, God will reside. The ultimate mikdash can only be in the land of Binyamin. Why? Why not? Because he was the only one not responsible for the Machiras Yosef. Okay, now for almost 400 years before Shlomo built the Beis Mikdash, there was a Mishnah that stood in the city called Shiloh. Right? Which is in the land of Yosef. But that's not in perpetuity because Yosef, you were also a bit responsible for Mechiras Yosef. The only one totally clean of Mechiras Yosef is Binyamin. And that's why basically this has to be a good place. Got it? Okay. Now, it straddles Yehuda's place because at least Yehuda, when he says not to kill Yosef, he says, after all, he's our brother. The next story he tells a son of his, after he's mourning for another son, marry his wife. He's your brother. You shouldn't die without any remembrance. Name a child after him. After all, he's your brother. Someone is finally trying to teach about brotherhood and Sefer Bereishis, right? So Yehuda, Yehuda gets his son. Beis Hamikdash just comes right up between Binyamin and Yehuda. I will tell you that this is an amazing thing. When Chanukah does not coincide with Parshas Miketz, a very rare occasion. Are you talking about this? When Chanukah does not coincide with Miketz, it can only happen when Chanukah falls on a Friday before Vayeshev, and it ends the day before Miketz. Otherwise, Miketz is always Chanukah. When it doesn't happen, you're going to read a Haftorah that connects to Miketz, which we just read this past Shabbos. What's that Haftorah? The story of Shlomo being ready to cut a baby in half to determine its true mother. Everybody know this story? Really? Okay, two women are claiming that the same baby is theirs, and that the dead baby in question is the other one. So Shlomo devises some kind of plan, right, in order to determine the true mother, and he says, okay, let's take a sword, cut the baby in half, and give half to this woman, half to that woman. Right? Very strange what happened then, because I've never met someone who gets it right, what happened next. What happened next? It was the very next thing that happened.
The mother. said. You have to know.
Everyone gets it wrong. No, that's not. I'm sorry.
So the real mother says not to tell her that the other mother is the right mother because she don't want the baby to be killed.
Yes. Okay. Because most people say you got it right. Most people say that the fake mother said, okay, that's fine with me. In other words, the point is that after the real mother said, give her to the other one, then she said, no, cut him in half. That's crazy. What did you go to court for? You have a baby. But she offered you the baby. Right? You could have let her have a baby by just not going to court today. Right? They're fighting over the baby. So the first woman said, no, give it to her. I don't want to see him. And then the second, obviously the second, these were prostitutes. They don't want a baby. She just didn't want the word to get out that she smothered her baby. She's the one who killed her baby, not me. Right? She doesn't want the baby. Right? Anyway, the point is that a whole room guessed, cut the baby in half. Wow. And then quickly the true mother came forth and said what she said. Wait a second, Shlomo. You left a gasping room of people think that you were going to cut a baby in half. Of course he was never going to do that. But what did those gasping people think? Talk to me here, guys. Come on. What?
That he's a murderer?
Well, that, not that he's going to, but that he can. In other words, what kind of... Why didn't they all scream and say, no, you can't do that? Instead they said, it's a king. Kings can do that, I guess. Yeah, kings can cut babies in half. And who are we to object? Maybe he'll cut me in half if I object. Right? You see, Shlomo made a room full of people think that he's behaving like an Egyptian king. Right? You marry Paro's daughter and you can behave like an Egyptian king? Read your Proverbs. You see what they say a king can do. But it's not fair of me. Because our Mishle also says, be careful, kings will do those things. It doesn't necessarily mean that Mishle thinks it's allowed. So on this, I just have to tell you that what you have to do, in addition to read, say, from the Egyptian Proverbs, is to know Egyptian rights of the king. The king is such an absolute monarch. There's no... And we sometimes do see some prophets going up to the king to speak to Tanakh. And then Chumash, the king said, why don't you let them go already? Don't you see Egypt is lost? And you remember? All right, in practice, we just see and understand that other monarchs did not bow to their prophets the way David does. Or again, some of our bad kings also don't bow to their prophets and they kill them. All right, be it as it may, I have the point is that the connection between Shlomo's story with the baby in Parshas Miketz is you have two people, Yosef and Shlomo, who seem to overstep the bounds of their position. The heavenly voice comes out as soon as Shlomo says, cut the baby in half, and says, cut the baby in half? Cut the kingdom in half. There's a moment like that also, if you know your Shmuel Beis. Remember David said to Tziva and Mephibosheth to split the field? Right? The Gemara that clears David of everything with Bathsheba and Uriah says that, no, but he still accepted the Lashon Hara that made him say split the field. So, okay, heavenly voice came out there too and said, you can just cavalierly say split the field, split the kingdom. Because David spoke that way, Shlomo spoke that way, and then Rechavim would also speak in a cavalier manner when pushing off the people's suggestion that he lower taxes and save the kingdom. Right? Rechavim, according to the first Targum in Koheles, is why Shlomo wrote Koheles. You all know Rechavim is Shlomo's son who split the kingdom. Why did he write Koheles? The first Targum in Koheles reads, and I'll paraphrase in English, when Shlomo contemplated all the workings he put into his life and into his kingdom, and he saw that his son would squander it all, he wrote Koheles. And it was okay, in Koheles. What are we working for? Anybody here remember their grandfather's name? right? Fine, if you do, if he's a famous person, he wrote a book or something. But people are going to forget us very quickly, right? Even if you live 90 years and you live 1,000 years twice, the Pasuk in Qehelet says, we're going to be forgotten someday. So what's it all about? So he says, make your mark. Teach a child. Well, yeah, don't worry if you're not remembered. Something you did in this world. You never know that you were put into this world for one little act that saves the life of Mashiach. Or that tells Yosef where his brothers are. Right? Rashi insists it was an angel. Ibn Ezra says, no, the story is better if it's not an angel. Rashi can't imagine that. The whole story hinges upon that man asking Yosef, you look lost, can I help you? Because if he doesn't, Yosef doesn't find his brothers and he goes home. You know what I'm saying? You never know. Your whole life is because today you held the door open for someone. And then that person was not pinned by an ambulance and lost his leg. And you never know. You don't know. Every single day. Be that angel. Be that you know. Right, don't get crazy about it. Just live the good life. And you are part of the machinery that keeps this world going. Right, Yosef and Shlomo both overstep their bounds. So Yaakov, of course, knowing all this, Yaakov incorporates everything in Bereishis. To you know, when the Shekhinah comes back to him, he knows everything, right? And he says, "I am going to take the who should obviously be king, and I'm going to give it to the one who challenges him." Of course, the way Yosef, the way Yehuda submits quickly to Tamar, right, makes him king material. Don't want to, Yosef. You knew as soon as they said, "I told you, you shouldn't have sold him," and he was crying out to us in the pit. And I told you that you should, you know, in the story of Vayeshev, it doesn't say he was crying out in the pit. You know what I'm saying? Can you really feel, do you have a sense of storytelling? Why doesn't Vayeshev tell us he was crying out in the pit? Why do we have to learn it in the Kates when the brothers are talking and Reuven says to them, don't you see now that this is all happening to us because of what we did to the lad? I'm not sure how he's so sure of that, but okay. And he was crying out to us from the pit and we didn't listen. He doesn't say by Yeshiv that he was crying out. It's hard, you know, why didn't it tell us in by Yeshiv? They put him in the pit, he was crying out to them. It seems that they were so hell-bent on doing something bad to him that day that nothing he could do or say was going to sway them. I'm sure when they were lowering him into the pit, he said, guys, Daddy sent me here. He didn't think he would do this. What are you going to tell him? Right? None of that is written in the text. Now, Yosef is really the tzaddik. He's so perfected, he does not tell his father. All the Mefarshim say, he does not tell his father about what happened to him. Yaakov incessantly asked him, until Yosef just couldn't take it anymore. He moved away. Right? Yosef and his father lived 17 years together afterwards. One of the reasons why Yaakov doesn't recognize his grandchildren is not because his eyes were dim, or because Yosef just couldn't take it anymore. I don't want to implicate my brothers. Right? If Yosef tells Yaakov what happened that day, Yaakov would probably, I don't know, look what he did to Reuven, Shimon, and Levi because of what they did. He probably would have done it to all the brothers. And then Yosef would have gotten what they thought he wanted all along, which is Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef, and we all fall away like Yishmael did, like Esav did. Avram had another 11 kids. What happened to them? Right? But that was Avram's choice to let them all fall away. Right? It says at the end of Parshas Chayesar, he took another wife. I don't know if it mentions 11 altogether, but he had a bunch of children with Keturah. Midian, Medan, a whole bunch of nations. right? Which is why Midian and Yishmael tend to be like mixed up in Tanakh, especially in Sefer Shoftim. So maybe that's what he wants. Who knows? Maybe Yosef could have gotten that at the end. So he has to do tshuva himself by not telling his father what happened. At the end, in next week's parasha in Vayechi, it says that the brothers, after Yaakov died, said, our father told us that you shouldn't kill us for selling you. The Gemara in Yevamah says that's a big lie. If Yaakov likely didn't know about it. B, if Yaakov had known about it, it's inconceivable that he would think that Yosef would now, after all these years, be so vindictive as to kill him, right? And the third reason is that if Yaakov did know about it and did think Yosef would kill him over it, wouldn't it make more sense for him to tell Yosef directly not to kill them? Not to tell them to tell Yosef? It was a lie. Okay, I really allow a lot of stuff here, introductory stuff about the connection of Mishlei to the end of Sefer Bereishis, and it's a good thing to get into. Let's go back to the last page on this Chuvaret I gave you, and it is why we discussed Tzadik in Russia. Last class we did Tzadik in Russia, Ha'isha Tova, and Ha'isha Hara. Right. Mishlei has a lot to say about this. This is where we left off. Okay. Of course, part of the symbolism of the Isha Tova is the very last chapter of this book. Okay. Let's talk about Znus. And you can see, just as a trend, do you see something unusual that really only happens... I shouldn't say only, but mostly happens in the first part of Sefer Mishlei. There are three parts to Sefer Mishlei, each one beginning with a new heading. Each one beginning with the word Mishlei. No. Perek Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph, and Perek Chafei. Right? So there are really three, like there are five books of Tehillim. There are five recognizable books of Tehillim, each one with an ending. Right? Okay. So, you see number seven, Znus. You want to see it? The last page. Do you see the trend that you can have Perek Beis, four psukim in a row. Perek Hay, five psukim in a row. Perek Vav, 11 psukim in a row. All of Perek Zion. You can't really see that too much in the latter parts of the book. Because in the latter parts of the book is just a string like Pirkei Avos. Of various proverbs for good behavior. Okay. And there's a pasuk in Sefer Mishlei, in Sefer Melachim, that says Shlomo spoke 3,000 proverbs, and he sang 1,005 songs. 1,005 sounds very strange. First of all, there's not anywhere near 3,000 proverbs in this book. There are 31 chapters, and it's not 100 per chapter. Right? Okay, fine. He wrote other. This is his best. Right? But what's 1,005? It's a great shiur to elaborate on what that means. I'll just tell you in a nutshell. There's a pasuk at the end of Qehelet that says Ha'elef lecha Shlomo. Here is 1,000 to you, Shlomo. And the Malbim says that that's referring to his songs. That even though I'm teaching you all about how life isn't fair, you still got to sing. You still got to say Shir Hashir. You still got to find the good, right? I would tell you that Qehelet is actually an upbeat book. Shir Hashir is the saddest book in the Tanakh. It's all about two people who are in love who never get to meet and never consummate their love. Nothing sadder than that. Qehelet is like a bad dream that you use to fix things. Yeah, life isn't fair. Go ahead, make it fair. What's the Elef Lecha Shlomo is the 1,000 songs at the end of Qehelet. And what about these extra five? So the Malbim ingeniously shows that Shir Hashirim has five different stories in it. Shir Hashirim is the best of the 1,000, and it's five on top of them. and they correspond to five times that God speaks to Shlomo in his life. The last one is devastating. The last one, after Shlomo lets his wives run the kingdom, and he builds altars to other gods, and he builds temples. The Gemara talks about whether he did it or not, whether they did it. Okay, I'll give him a pass. But at the end, God says, "I'm turning against you. Your kingdom is going to be split." And apparently, that's when he wrote Koheles, according to the first Targum. Right? But each time God appears to Shlomo, it's another song in Shir HaShirim. The last song of Shir HaShirim is devastating because it ends with the two lovers not getting together. The man and the woman, God and Israel, were left waiting for God's return. God says, "Don't, you're going to have to call me. Okay, you're going to have to look for me." Okay? All right, so now what we're going to do next class is we're going to see number 8, Tchunot. See that? Okay, maybe you can close this now because I'm going to just give you. Tchunot means tricks.